listening to a program produced in 2010 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org.
At this same stage in the Vietnam War, there had been a lot of fiction. There's been a lot of journalism about Iraq and less about Afghanistan, but certainly a lot about Iraq, but not very much fiction and it hasn't seized the kind of cultural imagination for good or ill in the way that Vietnam did. That, you know, by 1970, Vietnam was the center, you know, or had been for a while, whereas it's quite easy to go through, you know, a day or several days at a time with only the most passing thought about what's going on in Iraq and Afghanistan. And I know you have some thoughts on that. I wondered if you wanted to talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, I'm not a political scientist or an historian, so to take this with a grain of salt, I'm speaking mainly as a citizen and partly, I suppose, as a writer. And very little part of it comes as a Vietnam veteran. But one take on what's happening now is that the people doing the fighting are doing it voluntarily. They've joined on purpose, whereas I was grabbed by the neck and went kicking and screaming, as did a good deal of, you know, many of the members of my company. Some of us indifferent to the war, some of us utterly ignorant of everything about it, some of us hating it, myself included, some for it, pro, you know, very patriotic and, you know, thinking that the cause was just. But the temperament of the people fighting in Vietnam versus the temperament of those fighting in Afghanistan and Iraq is really different. I did a piece for Parade magazine I was telling you about over dinner, where I went to Brooke Army Medical Center to interview the casualties of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And these were people horribly, you know, butchered, lost limbs and terrible burn victims. Where the worst of the worst casualties would go there into Walter Reed. And without exception, the people I interviewed, and there were many, had not the slightest compunction about the rectitude of the war. There were no doubts. The phrases that came out of their mouths were the phrases of military, you know, war of, you know, against global terrorism and wounded warriors. There was military. It was a military diction, and that had been absorbed in a way that it wasn't absorbed by many of us in Vietnam. There was an irony to it all, in fact, there. So that's one take on it that I think is important. Another is that it strikes me that in the absence of a draft, the wolf is yipping at the door of Middle America and Dubuque and Sioux City and Des Moines, where middle-class families are having their sons and daughters yanked off to war. There's a difference with the wolf going and seeing the fangs at your front door from your son or your daughter voluntarily saying, "I'm going into the Army, Mom and Dad." Is somebody else doing it? The wolf, if it's anybody, is that person. That's a big difference. And I think that has something to do with the absence of much talk about Iraq and Afghanistan. I think that if one were to have a video camera in L.A. and you were to be able to zoom in on all the households across the city, I don't think you'd find many sustained conversations about what people are going through at this moment over there. Not just our people, but of course the little boys and girls and so on.
Right, except in the neighborhoods where those soldiers are being drawn from. It seems to me that what we've lost, and I think Vietnam was part of that too, but difference is a kind of sense of common narrative or common purpose. And so we end up with these catchphrases, right? Global war on terror. One of the things, one of the themes that you hit on repeatedly in the book is that it wasn't courageous to go to the war. It was actually an act of cowardice that you're
on my part,
on your part, that your narrator, and, but it comes up for other people say it too, that they were, they went because they would have been ashamed not to go, that there was an element of shame. And it struck me reading it that that was sort of a kind of cultural collective response to 9/11, that we, you know, we exploded in this sort of paroxysm of violence because we sort of were ashamed, or we felt we didn't want to appear to be cowardly in some way. And then we created this kind of this story or this architecture around it that now we're stuck with in some way. I wonder, though, and I wonder in terms of this book as a 20th anniversary edition, was there a sense of putting out this book into this world that we're in now, and any kind of, that this was a moment for, besides the fact, of course, that it was the 20th anniversary, but, you know, at this moment for a 20th anniversary edition, as opposed to, say, waiting 5 years and doing a 25th anniversary edition?
Well, I don't think so, but possibly. I think the occasion was really the occasion that's so rare these days that a... There are many, many good books published. They're well-reviewed, and people love them and read them and buy them, and they vanish. And it's an occasion of celebration and delight if one happens to be the author of a book that 20 years later is still being read in colleges and high schools and junior high schools and by bankers and you know, plumbers and veterans, people over in Iraq and Afghanistan and their wives and children, and it's still meaningful. I mean, that's an occasion for real celebration. It's also an occasion for real sadness, because I find myself talking about the same stuff I talked about 20 years ago, and in the context of what feels like an uncannily, eerily repeated circumstance. You know, we're intervening in a civil war. And there are all the factions from Vietnam that I recall, you know, who's your friend, who's your enemy, what's the front, where's the rear? And there isn't a rear. All the landmines, you know, blowing you up. And how do you shoot back at them? They're already dead, so you can't re-kill a landmine. And every day you can pick up the LA Times and you have 12, you know, guys or six guys or a woman blown up in an IED, you know, by an IED. And there's a when you have wars that are that similar, and I'm just brushing across the surface of similarity. I mean, I could rhapsodize for hours on what I see as uncanny similarities. You feel a sense of failure and of disappointment, because in the end, I'm afraid I've learned the terrible lesson that Vonnegut learned and Heller learned and Homer learned and Remarque learned and Crane learned, is that literature doesn't suffice. It's a terrible thing to realize that a great story is not going to trump a great politician. It's a terrible thing to learn. It doesn't mean that it's meaningless, but it means it won't trump it. Good rhetoric may oftentimes beat good literature.
Yeah, I mean, Vonnegut in Slaughterhouse-Five actually writes, you know, towards the end, he talks about saying that he was writing, telling a friend of his saying, you know, you're writing an anti-war novel, you might as well write an anti-glacier novel.
Yeah.
You know? Although now I suppose we're closer to an anti-glacier age than an anti-war age in some way. But I think, you know, what's interesting about this book is that kind of, I mean, it's referred to as a novel, it's referred to as a collection of short stories. It has that kind of reflection of the fragmented story, and it kind of keeps sort of cycling back and reflecting on itself and reflecting on the story it tells. You tell a bunch of stories, you go back and then undercut the stories, you retell them in a different way. You make us question what's real and what's not. How did that evolve? Did you start? You'd written two books about Vietnam, or a memoir and a novel, right, about Vietnam beforehand. How did this book sort of take shape? Had you written some of these things as stories and then started thinking about piecing them together? Was it what was the process?
I was having trouble with In the Lake of the Woods, a book that I finally finished after writing The Things They Carried. and a book I really love, but I was having incredible difficulty dealing with not the writing, but the emotional issues involved in it. It was a dark and grim and macabre and self-examination, and I was having I was having psychological trouble going to work every day because I was pressing inside myself in ways that were making me uncomfortable and was making my prose bad because I was trying to dodge it through plotting and whatever way I could dodge it. And I had lunch with my publisher, Seymour Lawrence.
The one who reviewed the book.
Well, yeah, the reviewer of the book. He didn't actually review the book. That was a mistake in the introduction. He was my publisher. I wish we could get rid of these guys and have our publishers review us. Man, what a better world it would be.
It's coming. I think the Huffington Post
book
section is...
Man, not coming fast enough. It's coming at the tail end of my career. Should have come years ago. But anyway, we had this little kind of lunch, and Sam was a... He was, in some ways, not a good guy. He was blatant sexist and, you know, bad with waiters. But when it came to one thing, he was great. He loved his authors. He was one of those rare cats who, once he took you on, you were his child, and he was going to support you through your bad books and your good books. He believed in you. And I confessed to him, I'm having trouble with this book, and I was contracted to finish it. And he said, well, what else could you do? And I said, well, I could write a... And I essentially winged it. I could write a book that feels as if it really happened, and readers are going to wonder, is this a memoir or is it fiction? And I said I want to declare that it's fiction on the cover and in, you know, the title page, and then I want to seduce the reader into thinking it may be real, it may have happened, and then undercut it now and then by reminding the reader it's fiction. And I wanted to use, as I was making the stuff up as I went, but I said I wanted to use my own name and then fictionalize event. I wanted to dedicate the book to the characters in the book, which would have the feel of a memoir. And, and ideas began multiplying. Reed had a couple of scotches. And essentially the architecture of the book was born out of a desperation to move away from In the Lake of the Woods. But I must say I left the luncheon much excited by my own rhetoric, and I couldn't wait to get to work. I had written half of the title story, The Things They Carried, but the title story reflected none of what I just talked about. That could have been published as just a short story. It would have nothing to do with the stuff I just talked about. And I looked at it anew, and I looked at it freshly, and I saw the possibilities of an investigation of what I do for a living, of being a fiction writer. Why do it? I mean, why not just write nonfiction? Why does anybody make anything up? Why do we have theater, and why do we have novels, and why did All in the Family exist? Why didn't they just film a real family? There must be a reason that fiction exists. Otherwise, there wouldn't be any. And when you think about what you're doing, that's what you do for a living. It's like asking why are there tile setters? It's because people want smooth floors. But why do you want a smooth floor? Why not have rough floors? That'd be fine. And so it made me want to dive into my own life as a writer and ask myself the hard questions I'd been kind of avoiding in the Lake of the Woods. I've been avoiding that because it was scary. And I came out of it, it was like diving into a wreck at the bottom of the sea and coming up not with, you know, some galleon that I'd managed to surface, but coming up with little artifacts, which are these stories that, as you say, repeat and look at the same story from a different angle, coming to the slow realization that as a fiction writer, I'm not saddled or bridled by the necessity of writing about actuality or what happened. I can write about what nearly happened and didn't, or what could have happened, or what in some cases should have happened. And, for example, the Rainy River story comes out of that impulse. I should have gone to the Canadian border, and I should have met old Elroy, and I should have confronted more directly than I did as a person this issue of moral courage, you know, going to the war. And I dodged it almost by forfeiture. didn't think about it much, and just went without confronting it the way the character in the book does. And so much can be, as a fiction writer, so much can be discovered about oneself and the world and through imagination. My dad died, it seems recently, I guess it was 4 years ago now, but I never said to my father in those last days of his life, you know, I never took him in my arms and said, "Dad, I love you." And I could have and I should have, but I didn't. For Midwestern reasons and, you know, and father-son reasons. And, of course, regret it. But in a story, I can have those lines of dialogue come out of my mouth. "Dad, I love you." And my dad can just sit up from the dead and say, "I know you do, you know, and it's okay. You don't have to say more," or whatever he might say. And that imagined scene of the words coming out of my mouth and the imagined scene of my dad rising from the dead and saying, "I know you love me," it makes me want to cry. Whereas reality just makes me sad. There's a difference of sadness versus tears, and that has to do with drama and sometimes really wildly invented drama.
You talk about that the last story or the last chapter of the book, which is about how stories, it's the voices of the dead, or the you begin by saying stories save us, and that's basically what you're talking about in that piece, and I think in the book too, that stories save us both because of what you're saying there, that the dead can come back and walk again, and somehow those things that didn't happen can happen. But also in the very last couple of pages of the book, I think you say, "I'll never die," right? You say, well, I'm not going to read it, but that's what you say. And it's very resonant in that sense. And I wonder, is that also part of that sense that, you know, in these pieces of writing, in as much as, I don't really believe in posterity because, you know, the sun will ultimately explode and that'll be it. And, you know, even if humanity survives, right? But there is that sense of kind of, well, we're all doomed anyway, but, you know, I'm not telling you guys anything you don't already know, I hope. But you know, there's that sense of kind of surviving, you know, whether even while you're still alive beyond your experience, but also that notion of you don't die. If there's a character named Tim O'Brien in these stories, whether it's really you or an extrapolation of you, that character survives independently of you, regardless. And is that part of the impulse as well?
Well, it is. I mean, it's to recapture that which is true for all of us, I think, is that I don't think there's not a person in this room who, if I were to utter the word father or mother, or presumably you had one, and if you were to close your eyes, some picture would come to mind. It wouldn't be the person. It wouldn't be the body. It would be absent. But there would be some image of your father looking at you over the breakfast table, or your mom driving you to whatever memory you may have, and there'll be a sort of a small reel of half movies, snapshots that we call memory, and sometimes bits of dialogue will be remembered. Well, it's not the person, literally, but it's something. It's memory, and the same way that I suppose one could say dreams aren't real, but whoever had an unreal dream, on the other hand, well, you don't dream, well, that didn't happen, and that didn't happen, and that couldn't be real. When you're dreaming, there's a different kind of reality. It's not the kind of that microphone being there where you can tap it and touch it, but there's something that has to do with whatever chemically is happening in our brains, if you're a biologist or, you know. But there's an undeniable something that, unless you're maybe a chipmunk, but I think even chipmunks may remember their moms and dads. I'm not sure of that, but, well, on top of memory, there's the whole business of what you do with memory and how you interpret it and the story you make out of it for yourself. And both in, say, war or in love or in a broken home, we make stories of our memories, and they can serve all kinds of functions. They can help us cope or heal. They can give us comfort late at night. They can get us through to the morning. they can teach us and instruct us in ways. And all of us make stories up of our lives. I think it's how we live our lives. Otherwise, what's be the point of getting up tomorrow morning if there weren't some story to turn the page and see what's the reason to get out of bed? And it may be a very general, vague story, and for others it may be very specific. You know, I'm going to rob that bank, and it's coming day after tomorrow, and that's my story. And you get out of bed, am I going to make it? Am I going to get rich? Am I going to get caught? Or I'm going to ask her out on a date. And that's the story that's on my mind. At least it's a scene in the story. And I've treated my life, I think most of us do, we treat my life that way. So that's part of what I mean when I say that stories can save us. They're not our bodies. And maybe not even save us permanently. Because the stories themselves will probably be effaced by time, the way, you know, there are a lot of dead people. And a lot of these dead people have been dead a long, long time. And they are nameless and anonymous. And their stories may well have evaporated. But you do what you can. And as a fiction writer, you try to save what you can, knowing in the end the battle may be, you know, as you say, maybe hopeless. It's sort of fun to fight the hopeless battle.
Yeah, I've always been a fan of it. but we live in an, and speaking of the hopeless battle, and so I mean, we live in an age now where I think our sense of story has shifted in some way. We were talking about this a little bit before too, particularly in terms of the kind of sort of useless ongoing conversation about memoir the last few years and what's true and what's not, which is a conversation that kind of relates in some ways to what you were doing in this book. It seems that we've forgotten how to read in terms of that kind of creativity and wonder, or how to listen to stories in terms of that creativity and wonder. And what we're really looking for is a kind of reductive sense of, you know, is this true, that we're buying into the prepackaged story, and that, you know, our political life or our public life is based on constructed narratives rather than actual narratives. I'm a maverick. You know, or right, you know, I'm going rogue, or whatever. Pick your story, but it's reductive rather than expansive. And I'm curious about you, particularly since, as someone who has worked so deeply with this kind of other form of storytelling and is so committed to it, I'm curious about your sense of that and how literature or story or real storytelling exists in that kind of situation.
Well, I mean, what I'd like to say is, but I would have a hard time defending myself, is I get a sense of incredible frustration when I address this issue. Some of the reasons you just talked about, to me it's sort of obvious that when people are so certain about the reality of things and the truth, and they'll say to me, well, what really happened in that book? As if I know. I mean, I don't. What if I were to say to you, what really happened in your life? And you'd look at me like when and where and how much. And then what if I were to say to you, what happened to you on June 20th, 2007? Not that long ago. How many of you remember anything or can pin it to a date? Unless by some fluke one of you lost a child that day. Then you'd remember. The same way a Vietnam veteran remembers if on that date your best friend were blown into a tree. Then you'd remember. Or over the day your girlfriend dumped you, you might remember but both, essentially, truth is this loose. We talk about it as if it's right in front of us all the time. And so my instinct is frustration. I mean, right in front of you, what truths are you going to enunciate that are right in front of you? And depending on who the person is, you're going to get a body of so-called truths. You're talking to a fundamentalist Christian, you'll get one body, or a member of Al-Qaeda, you'll get another body of truths. If you're talking to Thomas Jefferson, you'll get another body of truths. If you're talking to Charles Manson, you'll get another body of truths. Now, if you're talking to my dead dad, you'd get another body. Well, there's that issue. Is truth relative to personality and temperament and history? And then what do you do with truth that changes? What do you do with that? This kind of junior high question of what's true in your book? What will truths change? Somebody says one day I'm madly in love with you and the next day I'm divorcing you. And that person may not be lying on either day. The truth just changed. I fell out of love. And truths have a way of doing that. Ask Columbus and Galileo and Einstein, the truths that we were so comfortous and it seemed the bedrock of how we'll live our lives, we're going to be flipped on us. Well, I'll try going to a war and going with the truth of a good Methodist, thou shalt not kill, and then being told by, you know, your captain, you better kill or I'll court-martial your ass. You better do it. You better or you're going to go to jail. And, man, you take that, if you, where truths go upside down on you, and, boy, that's, you start to question. In situations such as that, or if you've developed breast cancer, or all the horrors that can visit the, you know, the human being, and the joys that can visit the human being, it makes one skeptical of that junior high question, you know, well, what's true? As if there's some solid truth floating around, I'm going to grab it and say, here it is, right here. And that's all that stuff seems obvious to me, but I get hyped up on it because I'm frustrated by the, I'm frustrated by the question, because the question seems to me the question of the chipmunks and of the gophers who, those acorns are true. I'm gonna eat them, and that's life. Right. And that doesn't seem human to me. It seems as if one's been the victim of sort of a truth propaganda machine that's sort of in the water of the world, and people are drinking too much of it.
Yeah, I mean, it seems either infantile or ignorant to me. Either if you know, infantile to have to believe in something that's absolute, rather than this kind of subjective stew we all float in. But I'm curious, in terms of, say, the relationship of this book to If I Die in a Combat Zone, which was a nonfiction right. book, and this is a fiction book. What was, I mean, when you sat down to write this book, was there a difference of approach? Was there a difference of thinking about it? I mean, did you even think about genre at all?
If I Die was written when I was young. I was 22 when I began it, or something like that, and maybe 26 when I finished it. And it suffers from the sentences. I mean, and no matter what your philosophies and themes and the big substantial stuff may be, it nonetheless has to finally ride on prose. And the prose is 26 letters in our alphabet. That's it. And some punctuation marks. And you can make out of those 26 letters, you can make Hustler magazine and Stud, or you can make Ulysses, or the Bible, or you can make you can make Mein Kampf. Or the same 26, sort of like the amino acids, you know, and the bases that make up the double helix. I mean, four bases, anine, guanine, cytosine, and thymine. And you come from it, and the wolves come from it, the leaves come from it, the organic stuff comes from it. So that's what writers have. And as a young man, I was trying to attack the stuff of Vietnam and I don't know how one describes it, but the material of trauma and the material of guilt and of sin and of some plaintive hope for redemption with inadequate tools. Not understanding as fully as I should have and that it's going to have to ride on some, it's going to have to ride on a phrase and on rhythm and on sentences that will help carry your reader through it in a unique and fresh sort of way and not a stale, autobiographical, been there kind of way. And there's no doubt that If I Die has the virtue of honesty. I tried to be honest. And there's no doubt that the things they carried doesn't enjoy that virtue. It enjoys another virtue, which is the virtue of public lying and dishonesty. And what that can accomplish in our lives, storytelling or invention. And that's the difference, I think. It may be the difference between maturity and, sort of a jejune ignorance.
Or distance. I think of it in terms of distance, because I think one of the charms of If I Die, but also maybe one of its limitations, is that it's so close to the event. I mean, it came out 3 years after you came back.
Absolutely.
So, right? Whereas The Things They Carried has, maybe it's not the right word, but the luxury of sort of...
Yep.
of reflection and of a longer period of time.
Yeah. And I think that's true of most books about wars. And I think by and large, there may be exceptions, I don't know about them, but There may well be, but by and large, the books that I know and love that have come, been born in war, have two things about them. One is there's a period of reflection and a period of, as you say, distance. But they also have a quality of not holding up a mirror to the experience. I'm just going to reflect it in this mirror. It's refracted instead through the lens of maturity and of thought, and books that are too close to the experience have that mirror feeling as if everything's important, every detail. Got to write about that grain of sand. I got to write that guy. I got to get his first name correct. And I'm not going to deviate. Even if it's a stupid first name, I'm going to use it anyway. Even if it makes people laugh, I'll use it. Gomer died. And you hear the word Gomer, and you think Gomer Pyle, and it wrecks the book. Even though it's his real name, the book is ruined. Even though the story may be poignant and tender and beautiful, the word Gomer is going to get to you because it's a bad name for the character. And no matter how real it is, and you multiply that by lots of examples, that shows you the flaws of If I Die, where I was too wedded to reality. And I would recount things in the book that way beyond what their due, their dramatic due. Yeah, that was important when this chaplain, was telling me, in the real world, go to Nam and kill people. Your country wants you to, and God does. I did it in great detail, and way too great a detail, to the point where it seemed I made a buffoon out of a buffoon. When it would be more clever and more lasting and enduring to unbuffoonize him a little bit and to give him some quality of the angels that I didn't give him, which would make the crime worse. It's when buffoons do bad things, it's not very surprising and they're just buffoons. But when St. Peter or one of the apostles does something terrible, the terrible quality is magnified by Judas did that, made worse.
I also think that the other thing that it gives you is that distance or even the maturity is you realize that there are less answers than questions. And it seems to me that the things they carried, not just because of the blurring of the lines and all that, but as a book about questions, it's a book about you asking yourself a lot of questions, but in the way that the stories kind of spin back and back on each other, it's a book that makes us ask questions, and that somehow seems to me truer probably to this experience, which I only know through reading about it, but also to sort of experience in general. The more I live, the less I know. It's the cliche, yeah. But it's actually true.
I think that's why the book has lasted. If it were just a book about war, but it's a book that plainly begs to be read, if only by this final conclusive chapter about a little girl dying and named Linda. And it's meant to lead you out of war into your own life and things that happen to all of us that are around us that I'm pretty sure that anybody in this room could write a book with the things they carried about their life and lives, his or her life, and write a compelling book with the adequate tools that you'd begin with the physical burdens and you'd move into the emotional burdens and you'd have the things they carried in a sense. And there'd be my intent in that final chapter was to try to swing a door open that left Vietnam and tried to enter the world of my own childhood and yours, that asked you to leave Vietnam and invite you to look at the things you carry. There was a piece in the New York Times about, 6 years ago or 7 years ago, called The Things They Carried. It was, they just stole my title. And the piece was about the things travelers in airports carry on their person. You put in those little trays and you put your keys in, and some reporter just stood there and looked at the stuff that was deposited in those trays for a couple of days and then wrote a piece about what he'd learned about the characters and backgrounds of people or surmised or thought he had learned. It was fascinating. And on top of the physical artifacts, the piece moved in. It was one of these post, 9/11 pieces about the collective burden we all carry as we go into LAX or any airport, and behold a security apparatus that wasn't there in that way, and with that severity before it. And the collective memory of those twin towers coming down that we all will carry to the grave. And it was a very nicely done piece, and it was not Nam, and thank God.
Well, thank you very much.
Pleasure.
I really appreciate it. And we're going to turn it over to some questions. From you guys, so raise your hands. There are microphones there and there, and we'll send them down. Don't be shy. Oh, sorry? Yeah, I'll call on them. But are their hands up? Yeah, there's a gentleman over there.
I read somewhere a while ago that your son once asked you why you continued to write about the Vietnam War. This may have been a few years ago. I wonder if you've given that question and an answer any more thought.
I have. He's the kid would ask the question when he was 4. He's now 6. And there's actually a 4-year-old that's replaced him now asking this. The question wasn't quite that. The question was, what is war? And try explaining that to a 4-year-old. That's a really hard thing to describe. And I you said people get mad at each other and sometimes they can't settle it with words and bad, you know, violence and so on. And he looked at me with a kind of astonishment that, you mean kill each other? And I said, yeah, sometimes it comes to, he said, really, kill? And I said, yeah. And he said, you mean like on TV? And I said, no, not like on TV, like really kill. Like daddy's going to lie here dead in front of you. And I tried to let him know what the reality of it. Well, should I have done that or not? I don't know. Was I a bad father or a good father? I have no idea. I'm just learning the trade. But I think probably in the end, it's, you know, I may turn him into a serial killer, but it will be out of good motives, trying to be real with him in the way I felt. I could tell when adults were pulling back and not really leveling with me through a kind of patronizing, a word, by the way, which is, you know, patronizing, fitting. This is the same kid who I found in the bathroom. How long ago was it? I don't know. Long, not that long ago. I found him peeing into a wastebasket in a bathroom that had been recently carpeted. And not just a wastebasket, but a wire mesh wastebasket. And I said, you know, why are you doing that? Why are you? And I got really angry. I lost it. I was too loud and too severe, but I kept saying, why? Because he knew better, you know, not some infant. And I made him get down on his hands and knees and with toilet paper, like blotting it up, and it just made it all worse because that stuff disintegrates. And finally, my wife took over, and she shooed me out of there. I went back to my study, and about an hour later, an hour and a half, the kid came into my office, and he said, Daddy, Daddy. I said, what? And he said, I've got two heads. And I said, what do you mean? He said, I've got two heads. He said, one head said, Mommy's not going to like this. And the other head said, this is going to be fun. That night in bed, I tell the kids stories. I mean, stories are part of, I think, what it is to be a parent and to be a human being, as you mentioned earlier. I think it's encoded in us. And I said, well, you know, I knew somebody who had two heads once upon a time. And the kid said, what was his name? And I said, his name was Daddy. And he looked at me as if searching for the extra, like the scar, you know, where the head had been. And he said, what do you mean? I mean, he said, really? I said, yeah, I was back in my college years. And I began telling the Rainy River story, more or less, the story of a guy who hates the war, doesn't want to go to it, thinks it's immoral, doesn't want to kill anybody, and doesn't want to die. And then the other head saying, everybody's going to think you're a coward, and maybe you are, and maybe all this conscience stuff is simply a smokescreen for your own fear of dying. And these two heads yakking at each other like Tweedledum and Tweedledee for 7 months as Vietnam approached. Well, Tad's long asleep, and I'm kind of talking to myself. but that's as close as I can get through stories. You know, the two heads, I think he kind of half understood until he dozed off.
Next question in the back over there.
In going after Cacciato, why did you use Muy Bataingan as a place of peaceful solitude?
What? I'm sorry, I couldn't hear that.
In going after Cacciato, why did you use Muy Bataingan as a place of peaceful solitude?
Why did you use what?
Cape Bataingan.
Oh, Cape. I don't think it was a place of solitude. I think Paris was the place of solitude. I thought Cape Bataingan was a place of nightmare. It was the location for the observation post where he's recollecting the people who have died. So the whole novel takes place in one night where he's on guard and part of his brain is going back to the casualties and part of his brain is fantasizing getting the hell out of there and we'll walk to Paris. For those who don't know, the Bataingan Peninsula was a place that had been defoliated. Apparently you were there, right? I gathered from your question, and I was there. It was just littered with mines and booby traps of all sorts. It was a terrible, terrible place on the planet. And even 10 or 15 years later, it remained terrible. That is the chemicals in the earth and the kids still getting blown up by mines there. The defoliants that had turned to villages into smile factories where the doctors had to go over and repair cleft palates by the hundreds, really. I mean, it was just something terrible had happened. A terrifying place. And it seemed a setting where for reflection. A bit like if you went to Custer, the battleground of Custer's Last Stand or the battle, Troy, where with the sound of the wind and the horrors, there's a proximity, accompanying proximity to one's own breath. I'm still breathing, and that places like that have for me. Hemingway has written about that, and Homer wrote about it. The ghostly feel of that river that it was crossed by Hannibal, or that village called Milai, lying so benignly in the paddies, where so much horror had happened, which is a village very close to the Bataingan Peninsula. It's not maybe 5 clicks away. Not very that 5 kilometers. Not very close. Maybe not even that.
Right in the front, over here.
Thank you so much. This is such an interesting evening. I was wondering if you had wanted to be a writer before you went to Vietnam.
I did. I wanted to be. That's the crucial word. I'd wanted to be a writer from the time I was a little boy, in a sense. So there was I can remember certain images from my childhood. One is of my dad sitting in the living room in Worthington, Minnesota. It was evening, and he had a light on behind him, and he was reading a book. And looking at his face and seeing this rapture in his face, as he was so absorbed in this book, with a little semi-smile on his face, and my desire as a little boy so wanting to be the book, to be looked at the way he was looking into that book. My dad was a bad alcoholic, and things were pretty tough in the house, and I didn't get much attention from him that I can recall. And I wanted to be the book. He was a great reader. And when sober, a terrific talker about books. He was on the town library board and had grown up in Brooklyn and had this kind of Brooklyn gift of gab and secretly, not secretly from his friends, but not secret from me, he wanted to be a writer from the time he was maybe my age, but never had that quality that I did have, which was the qualities of a donkey, essentially, that I was stubborn and I was gonna do it. And my dad was not a donkey. He was an eagle or something else. And you got to be kind of a donkey to sin. So there was that recollection, that image of my dad, light behind my dad in particular, and a look on his face. For me, books were, from the time I was little, they were an escape from my problems in the house and problems of poverty and where's the next dime coming from. And books were an escape from so much. Thank God for libraries where they were free. I mean, we're in one now. And at least free to, you know, to me. Somebody had to pay the taxes, but I wasn't. And they were a means of dealing with it all and of losing myself in a book. And I wasn't Tim anymore. I was, you know, that person for a little while. And something about what books were just doing in my life. They weren't artifacts to be studied and memorized. They were active in my life and maybe some ways saved my life that made me want to do it myself. I wanted to do it. But I feared it at the same time. And I think probably if Vietnam hadn't collided with my life, I may have found ways to have avoided it for the rest of my life. But Vietnam did collide with my life, and probably some other tragedy would have, some babe would have walked into me, and that would have been, I'd have become a writer, or my mom would have contracted cancer, or something would have happened, I suppose. But it was Vietnam. And probably for everybody, it takes a nom in your life, where time slows down, those hours of night when you're looking at yourself, I think you need something of that sort to take the leap of faith into writing a book. At least I needed it.
There?
Hi. I'm here. Hi. With several students. We just finished reading your book from Roosevelt High School. And I noticed that there was an overwhelming fascination with Marianne, the character of Marianne from the high school students. I was wondering if you could just talk about what she represented in the book.
Well, yeah, there are two things. I mean, I can say they're pretty obvious, I guess. One is I wanted to pay some homage to Conrad, who had been a huge source of inspiration in my life, and I thought he was just a great writer. And so I wanted to pay some homage to Heart of Darkness. It was also my effort at writing my feminist story. Don't ever do that. I've taken more shit for that story. There's this old saying, you know, no good deed goes unpunished, and man, did I find out. It was my effort to say men and women are different, and obviously, but we're all human beings. It's not as if women are, you know, monkeys and men are snakes. We're not that different. We have
some women might disagree with this men are snakes part.
And we, yeah. So some did. And I want to say, you know, we're all in this human boat together, and maybe what happened to me would happen to you if you happen to be drafted, even if you are a woman. Maybe you'd feel something of what I felt, and you know, if you had to go through this experience. The story is based on an episode that I think is real, came out of the real world, where I was told when I got to Vietnam that a girl fresh out of high school had come over and had spent time at the Trabong Special Forces camp. And I didn't believe it, as most readers don't believe it in the book. And as the characters listening to the recitation of the story don't believe Rat as he's telling the story. And then I heard it again and then again. And then I came back to the States and wrote a book and that didn't contain that, and heard the story some more. When people come to readings, veterans, if they were in that area. And so I slowly began thinking, well, it's possible. I mean, All you have to do is buy an airplane ticket. I mean, nobody's going to shoot you for buying a ticket in Cleveland and flying to L.A. and buying another ticket and flying to Thailand and buying another ticket and flying to Saigon. It's not as if it's out of the realm of reason. It's not like Alice in Wonderland. You can buy airplane tickets. And you're 18 years old and you're a good-looking, you know, cheerleader and you end up in Saigon. You got a lot of guys will take you to the Chabang camp and be happily escort you. So the improbabilities of the story are really the improbabilities of gender thought. They're not really improbable. It's more improbable to get, you know, in some ways, to get drafted by your country to go fight a stupid, unwinnable war. That seems pretty improbable compared to this story. And so I wanted to write a story where that some of this was challenged. I remember soon after it was published, it appeared in Esquire first. I was in North Carolina, and I wish I could remember the venue, but it was some rednecky part of the state. And in the back of the room, it was a collegiate audience, but in the back of the room there was kind of an older guy in a pea coat and plainly had been a nom, and I could tell him looking at me with great skepticism. And he finally raised his hand and said, you know, and Nam, you know, if you had a woman over there, you know, if she was sharing a foxhole with you, you'd just try to date her. And I was thinking, I didn't say, I said, like, where are you going to take her, number one? I mean, you want to go out on a date? Let's go to Quang Nai. And he didn't quite mean it that way. You know how he meant it. But what he's forgetting, and I think we all remember, is when you're in danger and you're dying, and I think the last thing on your mind is going to be that. Want to go on a date, honey? I can't imagine it unless you're insane. And there's plenty of that too. Plenty of insanity.
I think we have time for one more. Is that right? One more. So, got right up here in the front.
Hi. I'm actually interested in the other female character in the book named Martha. And why is she, why, just that whole, I mean, I've read it a couple times and I never know what to think about her and that whole.
I don't either. And that's part of the answer is that there are certain, part of what I do is not to, there's a danger of explaining things to the point where they get boring. When you learn the riddle of people, you've been married one day too long. And you finally figured it out. There's a certain mystery that evaporates. And as a fiction writer, you try to avoid that. I have my notions as to what was going on with her neutrality. She's a woman who wouldn't declare her love for Jimmy and probably didn't for good reason. And it was sort of had a neutral gray look at the world. And I have a feeling that I know what's going on with her and why she and Jimmy are not cuddled up in Sioux City today. But I don't want to impress on the reader my explanations for her behavior. I want it to just be that she is neutral. She asked the question at one point, why do men do the things men do? And in that question, there's a kind of answer, just in the question. And in the character's inability to respond, there's a kind of answer, which is, I don't know, why do men do the things men do? It contains a wistfulness about means encoded we shouldn't be doing these things. And that's right. There's a wisdom in her that's kind of beyond her years, I guess, that she's based on a real person who, very lightly based, but still real, who treated me with neutrality and was a mystery to me. And to undo mysteries is to undo good storytelling in the end. I really believe that. Stories are not meant to explain things. Stories are meant to do, I think, the opposite, to unexplain, to enhance mystery, to make it deeper and bigger. That if you want answers, you probably should go to biology or chemistry or physics. Although even they, in the end, won't and can't address the mystery of, like, where did everything come from? Like, the big physicists, you know, smart physicists talk about the Big Bang and this little mass of stuff that made everything, you and me and the universe and the galaxies and everything. But they don't address the question, like, where did the stuff come from that was compressed? And it's because, I guess, they can't. But I'm sure somebody's trying. I mean, if I were an astrophysicist of that, or a cosmologist, I'd be trying to find a physical answer to it. And we have, tentative, depending on religion and philosophy, we have tentative stabs at answers as to where things came from. And the whole mythologies and temples are built on explaining that. But as a novelist, I don't see that as my job. My job more, not a job, my temperament is more toward pushing the questions farther than they've gone. When David, earlier in this conversation, he made a very smart point. That's a very good concluding point. He had mentioned, the sun's going to flare up and it's going to fry us all. Well, the answer to that is yeah. I mean, as far as science knows. And what do you do with mankind's monuments to itself? Well, one answer is we bury our heads in the sand and we deny it. It's not going to happen. Or you don't learn about it. You refuse to learn the physics. I'm not going to understand what's going to happen to me. Therefore, it's not going to happen, which is a very strange solution for human beings to take toward these things. Another is to understand it and try to undo the possibility. Just build spaceships and get the hell out. Which is sort of the eccentric guy in Idaho is probably building one right now. it's going to escape the Milky Way. And then there are solutions of the Faulknerian kind that more or less, let's prevail anyway and prevail in a kind of endurance and a wise comportment of our lives facing the inevitable. There are answers to these sorts of things that aren't answers. They're pressing the boundaries of things. And for me, good stories, from Hansel and Gretel to Ulysses and Sound and the Fury and books I've loved in my life, treat the world that way. They don't offer solutions or formulae for living our lives. They sort of press things, make it all more mysterious. And those are the books that I end up rereading and trying to figure out who was Martha and learn more about her, but never getting a real answer. I want to thank everybody for enduring what was really kind of a literary, I guess it's supposed to be, a little highly elevated. It's such a relief, I must say, to have an audience that kind of gets it. I can tell by how you're looking at me that you sort of understood what we were talking about. And it's so different from... going to some community college, not to not community college, but where everybody's asleep, and if they were awake, they'd be asleep. So thank you for keeping your eyes open and the smiles on your faces. I appreciate it.
Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, Errant Fox, City National Bank, Deloitte, K&L Gates, KPMG, Wallace Foundation, the Bujakchi Foundation, Dean Hansel, and Donna and Martin J. Wolfe. Media support provided by KPCC, 83.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. A loud theme composed by Larry Karish.